for AntiWar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton. This is AntiWar Radio. We're going to start with my good friend Charles Goyette. Hey, Chuck, how the hell are you, man?
Scott, it's great to be on your radio show, and it's so good to talk to you. And, you know, if I can get just one word in here at the beginning of the show, I want to tell you that you are just one of the finest talk show hosts in America. You know, I've listened to you, and I've followed you, and I've known you for a long, long time, and I think you are just – I listened to your conversation with Kurt Haskell the other day, and I just think you are probably the smartest – well, I'm not on the air, so I don't get to compare to you, but I think you are the smartest talk show host on the air in America. I mean, just head and shoulders above everybody. You've just become just what an amazing talent you are, Scott, and I'm proud of you.
Well, God dang, Chuck, thanks a lot, man. That means a lot, especially coming from you.
All right.
Everybody, you all know Charles Goyette. He's formerly our partner over there at Anti-War Radio. Sooner or later, he'll be back on the air, and then we can podcast his interview archives to you. But you also know him as the author of The Dollar Meltdown. And this is a really important book, and it's a very entertaining and well-written book. It's a great book. You'll love it. Whoever you are, you know, you get recommended books, and then you don't read them. This is one that you actually, you know, go and get this one. It's Bright Yeller. They got it right down there at the store, and it's got a melting Federal Reserve note, a $1 bill there on the front, and big red letters, The Dollar Meltdown, Surviving the Impending Currency Crisis with Gold, Oil, and Other Unconventional Investments. And even if I didn't know this guy and consider him my good friend, I would still tell you, run out and get this book. It's really awesome. But now, see, you and me got to fight, Charles.
All right, let's have it.
Well, according to the Washington Post today, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. And you know who does know what he's talking about? Ben Bernanke, the now reconfirmed and resworn, new term beginning chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, head of the Open Market Committee there.
Yeah,
and,
good.
And Ben Bernanke is a genius, see? He figured out a way to create trillions of dollars out of thin air.
Yeah.
But not let them go out into circulation. Only the bankers get the giant welfare payments, nobody else. And he's already thinking ahead. He's got a little Charles Goyette or a little Ron Paul on his shoulder screaming in his ear all day about inflation. And so he's basically conceding, you're right. And so what we're going to do is we're going to use our scientific methods to sop up all this extra currency, and that is going to prevent the destruction of the American dollar.
Oh, my God, this is pathetic. I was on a talk show in Baltimore yesterday, and I said, you know, watch these guys very carefully because they never tell you how they're going to unwind all of this this monetary base that they've created, this $2 trillion monetary base, a $1.2, $1.5 trillion in increase in the monetary. They never tell you how they're going to unwind it. So I thought, well, okay, if Bernanke puts out his testimony that he didn't give to the House, you know, he'll make at least a feigned effort to tell how he's going to do it. But he still doesn't tell how he's going to do it. He says, well, you know, we're in a position to pay interest. Pay interest? Where are they going to get the money to pay the interest? We're going to pay interest on deposits with the Federal Reserve from private banks so that those private banks don't loan the money to anybody in the free economy that might actually use it to, you know, like create jobs and build things and create prosperity. So it's still double talk. Here's what it basically boils down to. These guys, the Federal Reserve is like, for all of its other sins, It's a broken down hedge fund. And it's filled with all this toxic paper, this trash that was going to take other financial institutions down. So its whole balance sheet is all the trash that the other financial institutions had to dishoard themselves of so that they didn't go under. And so now it's on the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. How are they going to unwind this stuff? How are they ever going to get rid of that? Who are they going to sell it to? It reminds me of a story, Scott. It's a stockbroker calls up one of his naive clients one day, and he says, I've got this new Scott Horton Charles Goyette Company stock that you might want to buy. And I hear a lot of great things, and they scribbled a great idea on a cocktail napkin somewhere. And the client says, well, if you're sure, you know, then I'll buy some. So the client buys some. The next day, the stockbroker calls the guy up and he says, you know, that Scott Horton Charles Goyette company stock that you bought, it went up yesterday. Maybe you should buy some more. And the stockbroker says, oh, the client says, eh, it went up. Okay, I'll buy some more. And this goes on day after day, and every day the stockbroker calls and he says, you know, that company that Scott Horton Charles Goyette company just went up again. Maybe you should buy some more. And after a couple of weeks of this, the client one day says, no, you know, I think that's about enough. I think I'll sell. And the broker goes, to who?
Because he's been driving up his own price this whole time.
Right. And when the Fed says they're going to sell this toxic paper, to whom? Who is going to buy it? Or if they begin to sell all these treasuries that they bought, to whom are they going to sell them? And when they start offering, they're effectively offering more debt, more American debt into the marketplace. What does that do to interest rates? What does that do to the automobile salesmen and sales companies? And what does it do to the mortgage market and the real estate market? What does it do to anything? What does it do to your credit card interest rate? What does it do to anybody when they start trying to dump all this accumulated assets on the Fed's books? It raises interest rates and it kills any sense of recovery and explodes the federal deficit at the same time. These guys are between the rock and a hard place. I've never seen such a bunch of evasive double talkers. I mean, it's unbelievable. I thought Greenspan was bad. This guy's unbelievable.
Well, all right. So let me see if I understand all this right. This rock and the hard place situation basically is that they're trying to prevent the prices from falling, say, for example, in the housing market. And so to do that, like you say, they print all this new money out of nothing and they buy all the bad loans from the banks in order to try to keep the prices from falling. And I guess with an eye toward trying to keep unemployment from getting too far out of control, we're already approaching, you know, a fifth of the population unemployed by the real unemployment numbers. So
let me hold you right there, because that's clearly not why they printed all that new money. It wasn't to keep the house prices from falling, something that they certainly couldn't do in the first place, and house prices have fallen anyway. It was to bail out the holders of all that bad mortgage debt. It was to bail out the financial institutions. It was actually an act of theft so grand that it actually just leaves you a little dazzled at how capable these guys are at pulling this kind of stuff off.
Well, so I don't get it then. Why not just, if they're going to bail out all their friends anyway, why not go ahead and let interest rates rise now and liquidate all the bad debt, go ahead and have the recession? If we're going to have the high unemployment rate anyway, because that's the rock and the hard place, right, is that if they force the recession or even allow the recession to take place, the real deflation from the heights at which they've blown the bubble up, then they're worried about all the unemployment and all the shutdown businesses from that. But it seems like that's what they're going to have to do as the solution to all the inflation in the first place, right?
Well, they think,
and it seems like they're in between a rock and a hard place, but they don't have
bingo.
To be.
They're bingo. Well, I'm not sure that I understand what you think that they can do. The only thing that if they let all of this bad debt liquidate itself, they're out of the driver's seat. I mean, they believe that they control affairs. And as long as they can print money and as long as they can pretend to choose sectors of the economy to bail out automotive, bail out Goldman Sachs, bail out AIG, bail out Merrill Lynch and Bank of America or Wells Fargo, as long as they can decide who to bail out, they believe that they're in charge. Once they let the debt start liquidating, they are effectively capitulating and say, you know, we don't run the economy anymore.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, well, the common wisdom on TV is that, you know, if we'd had it Charles Goyette's way, the entire banking system of the world would have unraveled, and that, you know, say what you want about Bernanke, he took what was a terrible crisis and he prevented it from becoming the apocalypse.
Oh, that poor capitalism, that poor weak sister capitalism. It's so fragile, it's so frail. It was able to create all of this wealth. But in a fix, it can't figure out what to do with it, can it? It's such a weak system, capitalism.
Well, that's why we need bureaucrats, right?
Well, of course it's why we need bureaucrats. I mean, this is unbelievable. Look, the one thing that the capital markets are really, really good at is finding assets that have value. And so if some of these companies that were bailed out had to go to the marketplace, the market would have sorted out really quickly what was of value and what wasn't. And it's too bad if big names like GMAC or CIT or GE Capital or AIG had to go under. It's too bad. But the real assets that had real value would have been scooped up by somebody. And somebody that knows something about making automobiles profitably would have looked at the plant and equipment that General Motors have, and they said, this is useful, that's useful, this can be actually used to make automobiles, we'll take this. All of this other stuff that can't, too bad, it goes on the auction block. It's amazing how efficient capitalism is in finding real things of real value and bidding for them, taken down. There would have been people lined up at the GE or at the GM factory gates, anxious to buy the real productive assets of that company. So I don't know how we've what's
so alternative universe then is September 2008. Charles Goyette and Ron Paul get their way. AIG, Goldman, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, all cease to exist. They go out of business. They go to bankruptcy court, and other people get their stuff. And what? We're already on our way back up from this collapse by now?
By now, we're long since on our way back up, and there'd be some pain. But you know who would suffer the pain? Look, who is responsible for General Motors or AIG? It's the shareholders.
Right.
So if the company is badly run, if they put a bunch of crooks in there, or a bunch of bozos in management that don't know the difference between viable assets and worthless paper, and put these guys in charge, who should suffer the loss? Me? I didn't own any AIG. You? You didn't own any GM stock. Who should suffer the loss? Should you have a system in which people that do things that are inept or don't pay attention to their business are wiped out? Or should the people who are good at running their money, managing their money, and making a profit, should they be forced to pay for the inept so that the inept can go from company to company and bringing them down as well? So this whole bailout was the whole story behind all of these bailouts was to take money from people who had made good decisions with their money, and giving that money to people who had manifestly made poor decisions with it, so that the people who had made poor decisions could continue to make more poor decisions, and the people who had made good decisions would have less money to make more good decisions in the future. It's unbelievable.
Well, but Charles, they say, though, that with all these financial instruments and credit default swaps and all these things that these geniuses on Wall Street had come up with, that they basically created, I don't know, tens and tens, maybe dozens of trillions of dollars worth of bad debt in a world economy that's only worth, you know, 20 trillion a year or whatever it is anyway. And that the bubble, therefore, really is so big that the popping of it would be so disastrous that, yeah, we do have to tax Main Street from letting the consequences of this matter. That even now, right, aren't they hiding how many trillions of dollars of bad deals they're taking on over at the Fed?
Here's the problem. In the real world, the real losses are real. I mean, the people who, you know, paid $700,000 for a house that's now worth $400,000, that's a real loss. And they sit there and write their mortgage payment every month and wonder, you know, why should they do so when they'll never catch up? They're paying for an asset that's not worth what they paid for it. But the losses are very real. The losses have occurred. The losses have taken place. The bubble has burst. The only question is, who will eat the losses? And I guess that's the discussion that we're going to have. I mean, if you know, the whole thing has come down to an aggrandizement of the state. That the state, instead of the capital markets, instead of participation in a free economy by free people making decisions about who will eat the losses, the enormous state decides to parcel them out according to who has political influence. Mm-hmm. It's not a good system.
All right, well, now the center of my libertarian bent is opposition to the existence of the Pentagon. and the armed forces of the United States and the world empire that they maintain. And so, therefore, it could just be, you know, a problem that I have, you know, that my perception is bent this way. But it seems to me like America was due for a recession due to the collapse of all the dot-com bubble and so forth back in the year 2000, and that Bush was actually, you know, it was political advantage, but he was telling the truth when he came into office and said, I inherited this recession. But then instead of letting there be a recession, they went ahead and had Greenspan lower the interest rates and start blowing up the bubble. And then September 11th happened, Charles, and we had to stand strong and tough against, we couldn't let Al-Qaeda come and hit us while we were already on our way down into a recession and really put our economy on that much of a setback. We had a bunch of wars to launch, and we had to, from the point of view of the Republicans in power, everything had to seem more or less okay in order to get away with the wars. In fact, they told people that the wars would be free, right? Here's a stimulus check in the mail. Iraqi oil will pay for it, and it'll be all fun and no cost, and everybody hop on board for it. And so, therefore, it seems to me like my conclusion is that really all the bankers on Wall Street and all their scams aside, the real purpose of this giant bubble, much worse than the dot-com bubble of the 90s, that George Bush and Greenspan conspired to create during the last 8 years, was really all about the state's world empire, rather than just the profits of the bankers. Now, I mean, obviously, these are all kind of the same thing when Goldman Sachs runs the treasury and what have you. But wasn't that what this is really all about, taking over the world, Charles?
Well, let me even reduce it to even more simple terms, and it may be that I'll be accused of being simplistic, but of course that's part of it. But what is the fundamental drive behind all of these people? The fundamental drive is power. So you can simplify it, and it didn't have to be 9/11, and it didn't have to be Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan and Yemen, and it didn't have to be any of that. It could have been anything, but it was all about power. And so the people in the seats in Washington wanted to inflate their power, and it could have been for any reason, and it historically has been for virtually any reason. So that's what it was all about. It was about perpetuating their power, and you know, easy credit meant happy constituents, and blowing up the money supply meant armaments deals meant more checks from lobbyists for defense contractors. I mean, it could have been, you know, I remember looking back in 2000 before the 9/11 event even happened, and looking at the enormous pork that was going to the helicopter manufacturers for South America.
Yeah, Plan Colombia.
Sure, for Plan Colombia. And it was, you know, instead of scratching one another's eyes out to get the contracts, you know, the lobbyists from each of the states involved decided that, you know, let's befriend one another.
Yeah.
We'll just buy a lot more helicopters and we'll divide them up between the two major manufacturers.
That's funny. You know, when Ron Paul talks about Plan Colombia, he says, you know, you don't see concerned parents or anything pushing for this drug war. It's nothing but helicopter lobbyists walking around the Capitol building during the discussions about how much money to give Colombia for their war against their own people there.
Yep.
Yeah, well, so, look, to boil this down, what you say in the dollar meltdown, I guess what you're getting at on this show today, Charles, is that we're doomed. That basically the damage is done. The crop of total Great Depression and disaster for the next generation has already been sown. The dollar will break. It's only a matter of whether it's going to be in Obama's first or second term or what.
It's a done deal. I guess the question is timing, but I mean, it's unfolding before our very eyes. You look at California. California's broke, right? You know.
That's what they say.
Okay. So what does the federal government do under the circumstances? It is going to have to print money.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at the talking heads and what passes for economic wisdom in Washington. They want the European Union to print money to bail out Greece. Well, how much more so the federal government to print money to bail out California? So where do they, you know, I mean, what does this mean for the dollar? If you look at the scope of the debt, it's not just the federal debt. It's not just the $14.3 trillion now statutory federal debt limit. It's the unfunded liabilities, but it's all the other chickens that are, to coin a phrase, coming home to roost right now. It's not just California. I mean, I'm reading a story this morning about Colorado Springs. they are picking up the trash cans in the city parks. They're going to take them in because they don't want anybody putting trash in the trash cans. Why? Because nobody will be there to empty them. So they, in place of trash cans, they're putting up signs that says pack your stuff out. A third of the city street lights will not be operative. I have a friend here in town, good free market guy named Roy Miller. He's a colonel. He's an Air Force colonel, reserve colonel. He was an Air Force Academy graduate. He told me that back when he was training back in the early 1970s, he was flying the Barry Goldwater Range, and he would fly along and wonder, why are all the roads paved on the American side? And they get suddenly to this just imaginary line, and suddenly the roads keep going, but now they're dirt. Well, America's about to encounter the new dirt road society, because the money has been spent. The debts are real. And it is. It's just a question of, you know, when is the Fed bail out California? When does the Fed resort to the printing press to...
And just like Greece, what we have is a situation where during the bubble, people are brought to be more and more dependent on the state, rather than in a good economy getting themselves and their own property, you know, more shored up. We have a bunch of people who now are living in their cars because they got into upside down mortgage and had to bail, and they need more food stamps than ever before. And the states didn't save up some kind of rainy day fund or whatever. They just came up with more and more ways to get people dependent on them. Now, the people who fund them are broke, and they're broke and can't take care of the people dependent on them.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's the other thing. I mean, you look at Social Security about to go flip-flop this year, and you wonder what impact has the creation of this bankrupt, deceitful, so-called insurance plan had on the propensity of the American people to save and provide for themselves. I mean, in the absence of Social Security, people would have known what people know in China. Nobody in China expects the government's going to take care of them in their retirement, and that's why they have been savers.
And they live in a communist country.
Yeah, and that's why they've been creating mountains of capital. That's why they're able to fund us, is because nobody has told them that somebody's going to provide for their retirement. So now you got all these blithering baby boomers in America. They're going to find out that there is no flipping money. The money has been spent. I'd like to repeat that, because when I give talks about this stuff in public, I get people to tug on my sleeve later on and say, no, I paid into that all this time. That's mine. That money is mine. I am telling you, you might as well have given it to your drunken brother-in-law, because the money has been spent. It is not there. And so, in addition to the money having been squandered, we lost all of the wealth that the American people would have accumulated in providing for themselves, and the benefits that would have had with the magic of capitalism and in creating more prosperity than you can even believe. It's just what these people have done to this country is frankly criminal.
Yeah. Well, and it's. This is kind of the funny part, too, is that, like, to hear Ron Paul tell it, it's mostly because they have no idea what they're doing. I mean, you'd probably be better off if you just grabbed Joe at random off the street corner and put him in charge of the thing. But so I wonder, you know, it's hard for me to get my head around all these gigantic numbers, Charles, and just, you know, when you say the money's already been spent, and, you know, this dirt road society and whatever. What you're really saying is that at some point we're going to have this crack up boom where the U.S. dollar on one day, everyone all of a sudden agrees that we don't believe in these things anymore. That's it. $5 bills become nickels or less. $50 bills become nickels, and people starve to death, and the country completely falls apart, and no sheriff's department can guarantee security anywhere, so there's troops on the streets and price controls and riots and insanity. That's what you're saying is coming.
Yeah. I mean, look, there was a Swiss academic who did a recent survey or research into all the economic calamities, the massive inflations and the hyperinflations just since 1980. And there have been a lot of them. And what he discovered is that when the deficit becomes 40% of the budget, that's the tipping point at which these conditions that make for hyperinflations and destruction of currencies take place. Well, we're there. It's a pretty simple rule, and it's very evident why these things happen. When the deficit becomes 40% of the budget, what do? You know, you get creditors who become increasingly skeptical about your ability to repay them when they see that the size of your debt is so, the size of your outgo is so much bigger than the size of your ingo. Then they become skeptical. So what do you do? Well, if you have a mechanism called a printing press, you begin to use it. So, yeah, we call it the crack-up boom. The Austrian school economists call it the crack-up boom, a great term given for the period when suddenly the guy on the street, even the man on the street, even the guy that just does nothing but watches American Idol, suddenly realizes that that paper money is a wasting, a declining asset, and wants to convert it for something, anything real. Rake? You've got a rake for sale? Yeah, here, take my paper money. What do you buy a rake for? You didn't need a rake. It represents something real instead of pieces of paper. A garden hose? You got a garden hose? How about a can of tomatoes? I'll take a can of tomatoes. You got a bookshelf? I'll take a guitar? Yeah, I'll take a guitar. Anything tangible. It's called the crack-up boom. But so help me, that's when it gets down to the level on the man on the street. As far as the real world goes, the real world already understands the problem of the U.S. dollar and that a default of one sort or another is imminent. And I've written about this and talked about this at length. I've talked about, you know, the Gulf oil nations, the Gulf Cooperation Council creating their own central bank, about India taking down 200 metric tons of gold for their reserves, dishoarding dollars, U.S. dollars in their reserves to do so, about Russia now beginning to buy. I mean, when countries look for reserves to hold, they look for something that has, you know, a huge amount of liquidity and so on. They're even down now to where the Russians are putting Canadian currency. It's a small currency. It's not the most widely traded currency in the world, you know. They're using Canadian currency to begin to replace their U.S. dollars. So in the real world, this stuff is going on all the time. Now, in America, this is a question of absolute amazement. I mean, Mark Faber, the Pacific Rim investor, doom, gloom, and boom reporter guy, was on CNBC the other day. Scott, he says, calmly, matter-of-factly, talking about the situation with Greece, he says, oh, yeah, you know, American debt repudiation, American default is certain. And they were all the talking heads there and the anchors there, they're gasping, they're horrified as that somebody would dare to mention such a possibility as though it could exist. But the rest of the world knows it. I'll give you an example. If the federal government announces tomorrow or next year that they intend to means test Social Security, that is an act of default.
What does that mean, means test?
In other
Sounds
words,
good, right?
Yeah. In other words, Social Security was sold to the American people as an insurance plan. It's even called an insurance plan. They use words like Social Security Trust, so there's trust. There are funds. Well, there are no funds, and there is no trust, and there is no insurance. So if suddenly the federal government says, oh, we don't have the money, we spent the money, what are we going to do? Okay, let's means test Social Security. That means that if you have money of your own, you're not going to get yours. Wait a minute, I paid into this for a lifetime. Sorry, if you have money of your own, if you have means of your own, you're not going to get it. So Social Security becomes
a test of your means, not of their means to pay you all the money they stole from you all this time.
Well, if you have assets, too bad for you. So here's the question, though. If a private company, you know how capitalism is so evil and private businesses are so bad. If a private company did something like that, you bought an annuity from a company that's supposed to pay you at 65, and they suddenly announce one day, you know, we're not going to pay you until you hit 68, or in the alternative, we're not going to pay you at all because you're already comfortable in life, they would go to jail. But the government is going to be forced into a situation doing this. It's an act of default. I don't know why CNBC anchors should be so horrified, should be so blindsided by the suggestion that the United States is going to default on its debt, because that's what Social Security means testing would amount to. So, yeah, the question is just how does all this stuff unfold? And my point to you is that the alert part of the world knows it. And by the alert part of the world, I'll tell you who's alert. The Chinese are alert to this. When
the other government central bankers.
Moody's said the other day, these Moody's guys who rate debt instruments failed to do so at, you know, it was like, you know, you get a warranty on your new car and 15 minutes after your warranty expires, the engine falls out, right? So 15 minutes before Enron went under, Moody's finally said, oh, there may be a problem with Enron debt. You know, it was Moody's and Fitch's and Standard & Poor and all of these guys that gave investment-grade ratings to all this awful, toxic paper that now is on the balance sheet of the Fed. But Moody's finally dared to peep up and say, you know, there may be a problem going forward with the quality of American debt. That was the tiniest, most insignificant thing they could say, but at least they said there may be a problem going forward. Timothy Geithner shows up on TV, so help me, he's on ABC on Sunday going, this is absurd, this is nonsense, there'll never be, America debt will always be AAA rated, America debt, this and that. And everybody just looked at him and nodded their head in America. When Timothy Geithner went to China last year, and spoke to university students in Beijing and made assurances to them about the solvency of the United States and the ongoing value of their United States investments in U.S. Treasuries, they laughed.
Yeah. Well, but and it was really, it was a giant auditorium.
Yeah.
Full of kids who, and it was a very involuntary thing. They were trying to be polite, but it was just hilarious. They couldn't help themselves.
Well, George Stephanopoulos, if he knew anything about anything at all, would have laughed at him on ABC. Or whoever's on that show. You know, they should have laughed at him. Instead, they just, you know, they blink and then go on to the next question. But the real world knows what's going on with the United States. It's only the American people. So help me, Scott, I'm prone to these Zen stories. Isn't there a Zen story about, you know, you take the fish out of water and you say to the fish, you know, tell me about water. What's water? You think a fish got to be an expert on it, right? And the fish doesn't know what you're talking about. Fish doesn't blink like Stephanopoulos does because fish don't have eyelids. But the fish doesn't know that, you know, it never makes any distinctions about water, doesn't know anything. It's always part of the environment. That's what the American people are about the U.S. dollar.
Yeah.
It's never occurred to them to think about it and what it is and what it represents. But the rest of the world already knows.
Yeah, well, and also the empire, as we've seen just in the last week when Obama announced this spending freeze that we all know ain't going to happen anyway because it doesn't start till next year and everyone will have forgotten by then. But when he announced it, he said, don't worry, we're not going to take one nickel out of the Pentagon. And then I think it was the Wall Street Journal had Robert Gates like making a conference call to the head of all the arms manufacturers saying, don't worry, guys, I got your back. And
yeah, it doesn't mean you.
Yeah, well, yeah. So that means that, you know, they'll cannibalize the country until there's nothing left except the army. And then we'll all just join the army because it'll be the only place we can get three hots in a cot.
We can go around and shoot one another, so we'll have something to do.
Yeah. Sergeant Goyette, Private Horton here reporting for duty, man. Boss me around. Who should I kill?
I'll tell you honestly, seriously, that you'll get your wish about breaking the stranglehold of the military-industrial complex. Because eventually, that's what it's going to amount to. I mean, eventually, and you know, the question is whether the American people are paying enough attention to decide to end it now. Well, they had their chance with Ron Paul's campaign in 2008. They could have decided to end it.
Silver platter, man.
Water until the last dime is out the door. But eventually, it will, you know, it will break down.
Yeah. Boy, I'll never forgive them for that either. I just can't get over that. Peace, liberty, and, you know, sound finances on a silver platter, and they told him no.
Yeah,
they had every opportunity, man, and they said no.
What's not to like about that? Good Lord.
Geez, I don't know. All right, Charles. Well, you're bumming me out, dude. I guess I need to start saving up at least enough money to buy one of them inflatable dinghies and a paddle, you know, to, like, try to head west. You know, at least I'm near the shore now. All right. The book is The Dollar Meltdown. It's on your shelf. It's bright yellow. Go out and get it. It's at every bookstore in the world. It's got a big melting Federal Reserve note on the front. The Dollar Meltdown, Surviving the Impending Currency Crisis with Gold, Oil, and Other Unconventional Investments by the great Charles Goyette. And when are you going to be back on the radio, man? Or we need to have this conversation off the air.
I get occasional offers and let's call them conversations. Uh-huh. And, I want to do the right one, but I'm also thinking that the world needs another book from me right now because there's some other things going on that I'd like to have a voice about. So.
Yeah, right on.
So we'll see.
All right, everybody. That's Charles Goyette. Thanks very much for your time today.
Good to talk to you, Scott. Thank you. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, man.
Bye.
All right, y'all. By the way, did I mention that The Dollar Meltdown is endorsed by Jim Rogers, Peter Schiff, Miss Shedlock, Lou Rockwell, and James Bovard? Yeah.